Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
Healthcare reform is about to begin in California. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Republicans say they want to repeal health care reform, but it won't be too long after California's newly elected insurance commissioner puts it into effect. We'll talk with Democrat Dave Jones, whose election this week was opposed by the insurance industry. Isn't Obama's reform more of a Republican plan in the first place? We'll also talk to a Republican consultant who says he knew Meg Whitman had lost the election when she said she'd submit to a lie detector. Later on, the new Congress and the old one's unfinished business. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Republicans claim a mandate to cut spending, but which programs do this week's voters want sacrificed? The GOP will be in control of the House, and the Senate minority leader wants Barack Obama to be a one-term president. Will the White House be looking for compromise? First, this story. Los Angeles Judge Peter Espinoza has blocked enforcement of the residential requirements of Jessica's Law. That's the measure passed by the voters in 2006, barring registered sex offenders from living within 2,000 feet of a school or park where children gather. The judge says that may undermine public safety rather than promoting it. Andrew Blankstein reports for the LA Times. Good to have you on our program, as always.
Good afternoon, Warren.
What's the judge's argument?
Well, essentially saying that that sex offenders are being forced to choose between prison and homelessness because of this requirement that they can't live within 2,000 feet of the school or park.
He says this is an issue of public safety, and he quotes in part for that the police chief of Los Angeles, Charlie Beck.
He is saying that, and one of the things that in a presentation to the police commission, LA police detective Diane Webb had said that certainly that they were seeing higher numbers of sex offenders who were homeless, but there are those who argue that there was no argument made with regard to higher crime rate among those. But obviously what the judge is saying is, look, it could compromise public safety, but it's also unconstitutional. So there's obviously a debate on the merits going on there.
Why does he say it's unconstitutional?
Well, what he's saying is that it amounts to a banishment, that you should be able to have a place where you can live. And as you know, in the past decade, there have been tighter and tighter restrictions on sex offenders. And in fact, as a general rule, you have this restriction with Jessica's Law, but for high-risk sex offenders, there's even more strenuous requirements. In some cases, state law says you can't live within like a half a mile of a school or park or a school. So you also have a patchwork of local ordinances, some of which could be more restrictive. And in fact, opponents have used that to argue that just because you're trying to block this provision of Jessica's Law, that you could get a situation where it's going to force localities actually to pass more strenuous restrictions and have exactly what the judge was trying to prevent.
Obviously, density of population has a lot to do with this. People who have been registered sex offenders need to go live out in the desert someplace where they may or may not be able to find some way to make a living. I understand the judge says he's got 650 habeas corpus petitions and more to come.
He does. I mean, in fact, he was in his 10-page opinion, he said that there were hundreds more that were kind of on tap. Now, again, I think there's a debate over how many of those folks are filing because they are in fact homeless or could be, and those who have found housing but find the requirements objectionable. I mean, what's interesting and what set this up, there was a Supreme Court decision, the California Supreme Court ruling when several sex offenders had appealed Jessica's Law, and there was they threw out a lot of the arguments, but one of the things that they said is that you could sue based on the residency requirements on the local level, and here you have obviously this ruling this week. And so, mean, what was interesting is I had a discussion with State Senator George Runner, who's the author of Jessica Flawed, and you cited the San Francisco example. He said that that really doesn't apply to L.A. That in a letter that he had written the judge last month, he had said that that San Francisco essentially had 17,000 residents per square mile, which was seven times greater than L.A., which has 2,500 residents per square mile. And he said, you know, that it's clear that people are finding housing, and that again, this is kind of an end run around this. So obviously, there's kind of a strenuous debate, and this issue is a very visceral one.
All right. Judge Espinoza is a local judge. One would assume that his order will be appealed, and that then it may rise to the Supreme Court once again, because obviously it has they've already started a consideration of it. So this would appear to be the beginning of a long process.
It is. And in fact, in the conversation I had late morning with the corrections officials, they said that there would be an appeal of this ruling. So this is by no means settled. And in fact, if the Supreme Court has said now that it can be challenged on a local level, you can bet that it's going to make a round trip back up there.
Andrew Blankstein again, reporter at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks so much, Warren.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. Republicans might want to repeal federal health care reform, or at least chip away at it, while President Obama is still in office. But in the meantime, officials in many states will be about the business of putting it into effect. In California, that task falls in part, at least, to Insurance Commissioner-elect Dave Jones. He is a Democrat who defeated Mike Vilines, a Republican whose campaign was financed indirectly by insurance companies through independent TV ads run by the state Chamber of Commerce. Dave Jones, welcome back to our program, and congratulations.
It's great to be with you, Warren. Thank you.
What do you intend with regard to insurance, health insurance reform?
One of our first and most pressing priorities is to establish the new health insurance exchange. That'll be a place where at least 4 million Californians will be able to get insurance. The rules that we write for that exchange will determine whether or not it'll be successful. And so I'm very excited about the prospect of participating in the implementation of that element of health care reform, as well as other elements as well.
What kind of rules do you intend to write, and how will they affect people who want to buy insurance?
One of the things we need to make sure of is that the health insurers don't cherry-pick healthy people outside of the exchange and leave people who are ill or those with a propensity for illness in the exchange. That would be a recipe for disaster. And when I say health insurance exchange, really what we're talking about is a online marketplace where individuals will be able to go and find information that lets them make apples-to-apples comparison based on price and get an affordable, comprehensive health insurance product. The underlying approach is to take those 4 million Californians who don't have insurance and use the buying power that they represent to negotiate better prices on their behalf, just like large employers do for their employees.
So then the question of numbers comes into effect. You don't have to have a private insurance policy that only depends on yourself.
That's right. And many individuals in the individual health insurance market, where 3 million Californians get their insurance, know full well how alone and how vulnerable they are. We've seen double-digit rate increases in that market, as well as other markets as well. And so this is an opportunity to allow people who are seeking insurance individually to band together and to use their collective buying power to get them a better price.
The Republicans in the House of Representatives now, where they'll be in control, are saying that ultimately they want to get rid of health care reform altogether, and that in the meantime, they're going to do as much as they can to slow it down, I think is the term that they use. What does that mean, and how concerned are you about it?
I think there's a lot of hot air there. I think it's very unlikely that, in fact, states throughout the nation and Congress itself will eliminate provisions like those that require insurance companies to let parents keep their children on their insurance policy till age 26, or provisions that require insurance companies to put at least 85 cents on the dollar into actually paying for nurses and hospitals and doctors, and other provisions that prevent insurance companies from banning you because you have a pre-existing condition. These are all things that I think there's widespread agreement about the value of. And so I think there's a lot of hot air right now, just as there was for the economic stimulus. You had a lot of Republican Congress people saying they were against the stimulus and then showing up to cut the ribbons for the projects in their own districts.
All appropriations bills begin in the House of Representatives. Is there federal money that's going to be needed to put this into effect?
There is, and a part of the health care reform was, in fact, putting together a budget and a source of revenue for things like the health insurance exchange. Here in California, for example, we've just opened up the new temporary high-risk pool, a place where individuals who previously could not get insurance because of pre-existing conditions can now go to get a federally subsidized insurance product. So no question, there will be some federal participation. But at the end of the day, I think that most of the elements will remain intact. There's still a strong commitment from the president and a Democratic-controlled Senate. The president and the Senate leader have both indicated that perhaps there'll be some tweaking, but I think on balance, we should move forward here in California and show the nation how it can be done.
Dave Jones, currently a member of the State Assembly and now insurance commissioner-elect. Harvey Rosenfield was the author of Proposition 103. That passed back in 1988. Wow, a long time ago. And it made the insurance commissioner and elected office. Harvey Rosenfield, it's good to have you on our program.
Same here, Warren.
There's also the Department of Managed Health Care in California. You didn't put health care into Prop 103. What does that mean as far as Dave Jones is concerned? Is he going to have competition of a kind?
Well, I wish we had put health care into Proposition 103 because it saved homeowners, motorists, and businesses about $62 billion on their insurance rates alone. And so I think for Commissioner-elect Jones, the first priority is going to be to make sure that he continues, and I'm sure he will continue to enforce the rules that have limited rate increases to only those that are justified. But the commissioner will then move on and get the legislature to do what he's asked them to do in the past, add health care to the Proposition 103 regulatory environment so that health insurance companies and HMOs have to submit their rates and practices for review by the public and the commissioner and the commissioner's approval before they take effect. That's something that federal law would allow California to do, and it's something that really badly needs to be done for the reasons that the commissioner-elect just mentioned a few moments ago.
Okay, so that might change things. Very quickly, isn't the health care reform that was put into effect with the mandate that everybody have a private insurance really something that originated from conservative thinkers rather than from liberals?
Well, that's certainly what happened in California when automobile insurance was required to be mandatory, although it was a bipartisan perception that people had to be responsible for their conduct. It's different with health insurance, which doesn't involve third parties. It just involves your own personal health. But the fact of the matter is that one of the most controversial provisions of the federal health care law was the fact that it didn't really contain strong rate regulation protection. That's what we need here in California. And also, Warren, what you alluded to, which is perhaps consolidating the two agencies, the Department of Managed Health Care, which is an agency run by the governor and also oversees health insurance companies, under the Commissioner of Insurance's jurisdiction, so that we save some public money and get it all before and within the control of the insurance commissioner, who's accountable to the public.
Harvey Rosenfield, again, author of Prop 103, which made the insurance commissioner an elected official. Dave Jones, back to you, our commissioner-elect. What about the efforts that you made in Sacramento to deal with the rate increases and the other issues that Harvey Rosenfield meant? If you weren't able to get them passed as an assemblyman, what's going to happen now that you're the insurance commissioner?
Well, one of the challenges I had was I didn't have an insurance commissioner who believed in extending Proposition 103 to health insurance. And so I am going to continue to push for that. I think it's the right answer. We have saved consumers literally tens of billions of dollars in their auto insurance and homeowners insurance rates under Prop 103. And I do think it makes sense in the wake of these double-digit rate increases that we've seen, Anthem Blue Cross earlier this year announcing its 39% rate hike, others as well, that the insurance commissioner should have the authority to reject excessive rate hikes. I think it would save consumers and businesses billions of dollars. I also agree that we should consolidate the Department of Managed Health Care with the Department of Insurance. It's a little bit of a historical anachronism. We're one of the few states that bifurcates the regulation in that way. It's very confusing. It's confusing for providers. It's confusing for consumers. And we'd be far better off, and I think it'd be far more efficient. We'd save more money to have that all consolidated.
Jerry Brown says he wants to cut down his office a bit. Would it save money for him if the Department of Managed Health Care were merged into your office?
I think there'd be a savings for the taxpayers. I mean, essentially, you have two sets of administrative apparatus. You have a lot of confusion. The regulations are not consistent, and I think we would all be better served by consolidating all of that under a popularly elected insurance commissioner.
Harvey Rosenfield, have you given up on the idea of having a public option in California?
No, to the contrary. I mean, I think most Americans felt that, you know, in terms of their dissatisfaction with Washington, one of the things that went wrong was the administration capitulated on that point to the health insurance industry too early in the federal debate. We certainly could do that out here, and I think if the commissioner-elect Jones finds when he takes office that some of the companies simply don't want to comply or do business in a way that makes sure that people get a reasonable policy at a fair price, one way to move forward beyond the exchanges is to have a public option here in California, so that people could buy health care coverage on a nonprofit basis and save that 30 cents of every dollar that the private insurance companies spend on advertising and bean counters who deny us care.
Dave Jones, do you favor the public option? Will you try to get one, if so, in the next few years?
I do favor it, and it was a great disappointment that it was not included as a part of the national health care reform, because without it, you really don't have a nonprofit competitor in the marketplace helping to drive down prices. I think it's something we should work towards. We need to continue to advocate and educate around the public option. But in the meantime, we also need to do a good job of implementing that which was authorized, and that's the health insurance exchange and making sure that it's successful. And then filling in the other missing piece of national health care reform, which is the absence of the ability to reject excessive rate hikes. I'm delighted that Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's been a leader on health care issues, has recognized this also as a missing piece of national health care reform. She's introduced legislation at the federal level, as we talked about earlier. I've been advocating for it in three legislative sessions now, and I'm going to continue to push for it as California's next insurance commissioner.
You want the ability to oversee rate increases. The insurance companies spent a lot of money against you on behalf of your opponent, Mike Vallines. They're going to spend a lot of money in Sacramento, presumably, to prevent you from doing that, aren't they?
I have no doubt, but I think we've shown time and time again that when California voters are faced with a clear choice, as they were in this election, they reject the expenditure by the insurance companies. In this case, they spent $5.7 million in ads supporting my opponent and attacking me. But the voters saw through that, even though those ads themselves did not disclose that the insurance companies were behind them. Voters saw through it, and I think we are confident that they'll continue to do so as long as we present to them the information.
Well, thank you very much, Dave Jones. Again, now a Democratic State Assemblyman and Insurance Commissioner-elect in California. Harvey Rosenfield, thanks as well to you, author of Prop 103, which made the office elected. Good to have both of you on our program.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Which Way LA. How did Republican Meg Whitman manage to lose the governor's race to Democrat Jerry Brown after spending at least $140 million of her own money and several million of other people's as well? Well, pretty much because she spent all that money and because of the way she spent it. That's according to Arnold Steinberg, veteran Republican strategist, author of textbooks on politics and the media. Arnold Steinberg, as always, welcome to our program.
Hey, good morning, afternoon, evening.
After
the election like this, you wonder.
You wonder. You've been up so long, and you're dazzled at this point. You use the term vulgarity in describing this campaign.
I think it's because the gross rating points were so substantial, the spots so repetitive, particularly early on, that people became anesthetized, and that almost trumped whatever messages they had. And at a time when the state's economy is bleak, people are having a tough time, it seemed particularly sort of more than out of the ordinary, almost offensive. And it also raised the specter of could somebody govern in a frugal way if this was the way they spent their money.
So she flaunted it.
She did, and I think it was a strategic error. I think it also probably reflected, sort of the kind of a CEO who's sort of an in-your-face CEO, and it's a leadership style that I think was very helpful to her because she's a bright, substantial person, a marketing genius in many ways, but it didn't quite apply to retail politics, and it really went against the conventional approach of that's used for almost everybody who's rich and spends a lot of money in politics, which is you really don't boast, you don't brag, you don't try to be a bully.
On today's LA Times op-ed page, you say that it started out in the primary.
Yeah, it started out, first of all, it started early on when she did something extraordinary, which is to announce that she'd be spending $100 million or more. The wealthy candidates with whom I've consulted, I've always come up with an internal budget. I said, let's keep this a secret because we want people to give you money. We want them to get involved. And we don't want the opposition to know what we're going to spend. And we don't want to seem like we're trying to buy it. In her case, she announced it really took me by surprise. And then, in a great error, she really misjudged her primary opponent. Many people saw Steve Poizner's kind of nerdy. He's a black belt karate. He's a very determined, forceful, goal-oriented kind of a guy.
With a lot of money himself.
And a lot of money. I mean, by any other standard, any other year, a guy who spent $25 million, you and I would have talked about how he lost spending $25 million. But he looks like a piker this year.
So she tried to intimidate him by saying she was going to spend all that money, and with him, just didn't work.
It had the opposite effect.
Now, on the other hand, she lost after spending all that money, but Carly Fiorina didn't run any kind of campaign like that or didn't have any kind of spending like that. She took a pretty conservative ran a conservative campaign against Barbara Boxer. She lost by a little less, but still by a lot. How do you reconcile that with what you're saying about Meg Whitman?
Well, first of all, it's a reasonable inference that ideology didn't play a role because she took a very conservative position and not so with Whitman, and she actually did a bit better there. I think, the reality is that the Boxer ad campaign against Fiorina, it was sort of humorous to see Boxer on election night celebrate her victory by saying it's been such a negative campaign against me. I think the negative ads against Fiorina were somewhat unfair and the jobs going out of the state there, taking her quotes out of context, but I think they were very, very effective. And I think that effectiveness cost her a lot of points, even against the backdrop that Barbara Boxer historically has run under 50% almost during her entire incumbency and been vulnerable.
Back to Meg Whitman, you say that when she offered to take a lie detector test, you knew she had lost the race.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. One is, of course, that she would think that her credibility is so low she'd make the offer. Second is, why on earth would you engage in a soap opera and give it higher ratings by prolonging this sort of Gloria Allred story against her, which she did, early on, a few days before, where she had, for the first time, an introduction to us, the electorate, of her husband in the context of dealing with the housekeeper a story there. I shuddered. I said to myself, boy, if I were the opposition, I'd take her up. You could imagine all the stories being done about who the polygraph operator was. Were the questions correct? Should there be an independent analysis? It would have been a national story.
Now, this obviously put her against Nikki Diaz Santillan, the housekeeper who wept on television and looked like she was a victim.
Yeah, I mean, we had everything except People magazine putting her on the cover taking a polygraph test.
If anybody tries to run in California again with that kind of money, can they win? The playing field is littered with self-financed candidates. Mike Huffington,
Al Checky,
Jane Harmon.
People may not remember, but a guy named William Penn Patrick years ago. And there a guy named Lee Kaiser ran against George Murphy back in the 60s. A lot of these people lose. We only remember the ones that win, or we see the Bloomberg in New York. But it's a problem because not all, but most of these wealthy people are sharp. Mike Covington inherited money from his dad, but a lot of them are self-made. They are bright, and they have trouble adapting, going from the boardroom where they have a handpicked board of directors working a collegial way to retail politics, where a reporter who makes an entire year what they earn in a day in dividends and interest can essentially ruin them.
Arnold Steinberg, once again, longtime Republican political strategist and analyst, the vulgarity of overspending. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, the new Congress and the old one's unfinished business on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. While the lame duck session of the current Congress is trying to deal with unfinished business, President Obama has invited the future House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to the White House to meet with the current Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Leader Harry Reid. Anna Fifield is political correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks very much for joining our program.
Pleasure to be here, Warren.
There is indeed a lot of unfinished business.
Indeed there is. They're going to have their work cut out for them when they meet for this lame duck session on November the 15th.
Not a single appropriations bill has been passed.
No, but President Obama made it pretty clear this morning that his first priority will be dealing with the Bush-era tax cuts and the extensions that may or may not be required there.
Is he still talking about allowing them to expire for people with incomes over $250,000, or has he given that up?
We get the sense that maybe he's tweaking his message a little bit here. So he said yesterday and again this morning that he was open to compromise on this issue. So what it looks like he's thinking of doing, and he's been very insistent all along that the burden on the middle class should not increase. So he's been very insistent sticking to his ground about the tax cuts for the middle class staying there. But of course, Republicans want all of the tax cuts, including the tax cuts for the richest 2% of Americans, to be extended permanently. So now I think the way that they are heading is to extend all of the tax cuts, including the tax cuts for the richest, by maybe 2 years, 1 or 2 years, and then that would implicate the Republicans to some extent, but without making them permanent. The other kind of compromise option out there is maybe lifting the limits on the tax cuts. At the moment, the top raise tax cuts kick in at $250,000, so people are suggesting maybe they could raise that to $500,000 or even $1 million. So there's some certainly an appetite for compromise there. I think the White House knows that it needs to give in some ground here. Otherwise, all of the tax cuts are going to expire, and that would really hurt the middle class next year.
The president said this morning that not only does he want to deal with those tax cuts, but also the START treaty with Russia. Tell us about that.
Right, so this treaty's been hanging around for a while. It should be, it should theoretically have been quite easy for them to ratify. As the president said this morning, this has traditionally been a bipartisan issue. And the treaty, which was brokered with Russia, calls for a reduction in both countries' nuclear arsenals by about a quarter. So it's a pretty important treaty and one of the White House's top priorities. But it needs ratification in the Senate, and some of the more conservative Republican senators are opposing it, saying that they don't want to see any reduction in U.S. arms. So that is something that I think will also face some kind of tricky passage.
Are there moderate Republicans that are for it? Is it one of the things that would have to pass by 60 votes because of the threat of a filibuster?
Yeah, it would have to vote, I think, by 67. It passed by 67, actually. So it needs a lot of support there. It's a question of whether the moderate Republicans will get on board or whether this new kind of atmosphere of confrontation here in Washington will take over.
Now,
it's certainly something that President Obama underlined very strongly this morning as well, that he wants to see action on that.
He also wants to see a compromise. You say that there's a new atmosphere of confrontation. He says it's critically important over the coming months to create a better working relationship between this White House and the congressional leadership that's coming in. Today, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, repeated his insistence, talking to the Heritage Foundation, that the number one priority ought to be making Barack Obama a one-term president. What does that mean for the prospect for compromise?
Right, it's not a very good omen, I have to say. I mean, there's a lot of political rhetoric around. Even John Boehner, the incoming Speaker of the House, was saying that he wants some compromise and people to work together and stuff as well. But I think both parties have a different idea, a different definition of what compromise means, whereas the White House thinks that Republicans should come on board more and work with them. But these Republicans have swept Congress this week and really feel that they have a mandate to resist, to push back against the administration's agenda. And they say that that their agenda of cutting spending and repealing health care and things, that is really what the American people want. So they say that President Obama should be listening to the people, and therefore Republicans, on this. So it was very telling this morning that, I mean, Mitch McConnell also said that that he wanted to work with the White House, but it made it pretty clear that the White House had to fall into line with Republicans rather than the other way around. And he, as you say, he reiterated this idea that their top priority, if they're going to repeal health care, cut spending, reintroduce fiscal discipline and all this kind of stuff, is to make sure that Barack Obama doesn't get a second term. So the signs are not looking good for this meeting that they're going to have on November the 18th.
Want to be a fly on the wall at that one. Anna Fifield, again, a U.S. political correspondent for the Financial Times. So things aren't looking very good for the rump session, the lame duck session that will start in a couple of weeks. John Fortier is research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks to you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let us look forward now. We've gotten a good introduction to what might be in store from Anna Fifield. The president today still talking about reaching a compromise. What are the prospects?
Well, I'm a bit skeptical. I do think that both parties are going to talk about working together, and the big issues, as mentioned earlier, are the Bush tax cuts, which are going to expire. And then ultimately, I think some questions about spending reductions. Both sides, I think, will say the election had something to do with reducing deficits. But after that, I wonder if things break down. Both sides will have different ideas about what to do about the deficits. So the Obama administration, I think, is still holding on a bit to having only the lower income tax credit tax cuts go on and letting the other ones expire. That would be good for the deficit, but Republicans don't want that sort of deficit spending. And Republicans, I think, will be looking at some of the subsidies ahead in health care, for example. And the president will say, look, health care actually helps us reduce the deficit over the long term. So I think that there is some talk of working together. There might be some small ways in which they will. I actually think the START Treaty might be an exception. That's something I think there's some insiders on the Republican side who might work with him. But on the big issues of the Bush tax cuts and ultimately spending, I think we'll see a lot more clashes than we will compromise.
Will the Bush cuts be extended, do you think, as was suggested earlier, maybe for a couple of years? Will they kick that one down the road?
I think they will kick that one down the road. The latest position of the president actually has been to allow the to have a temporary extension of the high income tax cuts and to have a permanent extension of the low income ones. I don't think Republicans are going to go for that. I think what's probably going to happen is a temporary kicking down the road of both of them, perhaps for 2 years, past both the reelection of the next Congress and of the president's reelection. That's my best guess of what will happen.
Is it possible that in this lame duck session of the Congress, Democrats who have been moderate in the past, the so-called blue dogs, will come around and give the president more of what he wants than they have in the future, in the past?
I think there's also always some hope among partisans of both sides when this happens that those moderates were actually truly more with the party. They were just voting their district, just voting to survive. I think in the most cases they're voting their convictions, and you look at someone like Kevin Bayh, who's didn't lose but is retiring, has reiterated some of his moderate Democratic stances, and I think those people are unlikely to come and bail out Democrats on votes that they didn't take before. There's a big wave that washed over the Congress. Republicans had the same thing happen to them in 2006. They wanted to do a fair amount in the lame duck session. It's hard to do given the changes in the atmosphere. The votes are still there, but ultimately I think most things will wait until the next year.
So even then, if the president can't get things done with his continued Democratic majority in the Congress, what are the prospects, John Fortier, for any kind of compromise on anything next year, again, given that each side wants the other to compromise by coming in their direction?
Well, I think there's some small things. I mentioned the START Treaty. Energy.
I know I asked you that question before, but I just want to
Energy, I think, is a possibility, although it will be a far cry from the type of energy and environment bill that the administration was talking about at the beginning. It will be much more heavily about energy, some alternative energy, maybe some nuclear and some other producing of energy, and not so much on the reducing carbon emission side. There are some, certainly education is some place where some Republicans are pretty complimentary of the president and his direction. He's been a little bit against some of the tendencies of some in his party. There's some potential for compromise on that, although I will say some of the new Republicans are probably against all sorts of forms of education from a federal funding of education, and you might not be on board with that, but that's a possibility. Other than that, I guess I see more conflict than compromise.
More conflict than compromise. Jan Fortier, once again, a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. David Korn is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine, columnist at politicsdaily.com, also blogs at davidkorn.com. If he is on the, if Jan Fortier might be on the conservative side, along with our next guest, Matthew Continetti, David Korn very much on the other side. Good to have you back on our program.
Good to be two on one here.
I don't know that Jan Fortier was all that ideological in what he said, so we'll see what happens when we get to Matthew. Continetti, what about this statement today by the president after meeting with his candidate that the critically important thing is to work for a better relationship between this White House and the congressional leadership? What are the prospects of that?
Well, I think the president's being pretty optimistic. The Republican Party, and more importantly, the people they're playing to, Tea Party types and others, have not been very discreet. Their goal has been essentially the destruction of the Obama presidency. Mitch McConnell has, said that that's his goal, a one-term president. Everyone knows that's always the case for the opposition, but he's made it rather explicit. And you see folks in Congress calling not just for repealing provisions of the health care reform, but repealing the entire health care provision. You have more climate change deniers flooding into Congress now on the Republican Tea Party bandwagon than ever before. And there is not, I think the last year and a half, you've seen on the Republican side, I hate to use extreme language, but a tremendous amount of demagoguery and the use of falsehoods. They've made their case against Obama saying literally that his stimulus didn't create a single new job. Republican leaders were saying that. Almost any mainstream economist will tell you it saved created between 2 and 3 million jobs. You have the Republican leadership holding hearings on Capitol Hill, on territory that belongs to all of us, in which Tea Party and other conservative ralliers have come, and they were chanting Nazis, Nazis, in reference to the Democrats for supporting health care. So if you're up against people who are willing to say anything, no matter whether it's true or not, and are willing to kind of compare you to Nazis, what is the real opportunity there for compromise on some of what we just heard are very tough issues, ideologically, policy-wise, to work out together? I think at some point, President Obama is going to have to make a call here. I know the public wants to have a president who makes everybody work together, play nice, and do what's best for the country. But if you're taking that position, but the other side is acting irresponsibly and then stopping you from making progress that the public wants, well, then you're kind of a sap. And so he has to make a hard call whether to sort of continue down that path of reaching out and doing it in a, and thinking that it can have an impact, or telling the public, wait a second, you're going to have to make a choice. I can't work with people who call us Nazis and who lie in that regard.
David Korn again, the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine, liberal publication. Matthew Continetti, already advertised, opinion editor of the Weekly Standard, author of The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What do you say? Does the president really have any choice at this point except to be confrontational?
He always has a choice. I think that based on his press conference yesterday, he seems willing to work with Republicans in some sense. I think the biggest, most interesting number coming out of the exit poll is on the question of, do you, in the long run, do you think Barack Obama's policies will help the country or hurt the country? 52% of respondents said that these policies will hurt the country. So 52% of the people who voted on Election Day think that Obama's policies will hurt the country. So this was an election that was rejecting the policies.
Wait a minute. 53% of the exit poll responders said the same thing about Republicans.
No, that's a different question. That, yeah. So on the question of do you support or approve of the parties, you're right. Majorities of voters disapproved of both parties. But on the specific question of whether Obama's policies will help or hurt the country, people said that they will hurt. So you can disapprove of both parties and yet cast a negative vote against the Obama agenda. And that's what happened on Tuesday. And to me, that should be a wake-up call to this president. I'm not sure if it will be.
Certainly it was a call for cutting government spending, but what are they going to cut? Are they going to cut Medicare and Social Security? Are they going to cut the prescription drug plan? Where are the big cuts that they can push toward the Senate with the hope that they might get to the president and he'll either then sign or veto?
Well, they start by rolling back non-defense discretionary spending to its 2008-2007 levels, somewhere around there. And then they're going to, I think, wait to see what this Entitlement Commission reports on December 1st. It's likely that some of the recommendations there involving the progressive indexing, so-called progressive indexing of benefits for upper-income earners, or also raising the retirement age, I think those are ways that they can tackle the entitlement problems. And maybe they'll start to work on introducing tort reform into health care in order to drive costs down, lower costs, and also start talking about restructuring Medicaid in terms of delivering it in block grants to the states and maybe changing the way that Medicare is financed as well.
Roughly how much could you cut out of the federal budget if you went in that direction, or is it just sort of too difficult to estimate that?
Well, I mean, the entitlements where the money is.
Yeah.
The type of changes that I just laid out there would save quite a bit, hundreds of billions of dollars. And the reduction, you know, lowering non-defense discretionary spending back to where it was in 2008 is a savings of about another $100 billion. So there are big savings that you could actually have.
Okay, David Korn, back to you with Mother Jones Magazine. What about that? Could the Democrats go for that, conceivably?
Well, they're going to go for wide-ranging cuts in discretionary spending, which is, you know, 20-30% of the budget at best. I mean, most of the budget, 70% of it or so, goes to Medicare and Social Security, defense, and paying off the debt. Particularly, they're not going to do it when Republicans are saying, well, we should give tax cuts to people making over $250,000 a year, which is going to add close to $1 trillion to the deficit. I mean, you're going to have cuts like the ones that Matthew laid out there just to make up, just to keep us even where we are now, which is already in a pretty big hole, if you go ahead and extend the Bush tax cuts for the well-to-do. So, I mean, everybody who's looked at the Republican numbers and all the plans they've put out said time and time again, they just don't add up. They're just not serious, nor are they serious on these issues of transparency. They talk about bringing transparency to government. John Boehner won't even say what lobbyists he's going to meet with or who he has met with. They've had no new initiatives for anything involving true transparency. So, I mean, you know, they're kind of fakes in this front. They want to, you know, bring change to Washington, to Capitol Hill. They can do it in a second. Just tell us all the lobbyists you're meeting with, Speaker Boehner, or, you know, and other members of your leadership. They won't
okay,
do
well,
that.
Okay, you're slipping away from the numbers here, and I want to get back to Matthew Conanetti. What about it? The tax cuts, the extension of the tax cuts for upper-income people could add $1 trillion to the deficit?
Well, a current extension of a temporary extension of the current tax rates would add to the deficit in the short term. But you have to weigh that cost against the cost that would be on the economy if you were to raise taxes in the middle of this weak recovery that we're experiencing right now. And I think Republicans say that they'd rather have low taxes in the short term while the economy recovers and then address the longer term issues down the road.
So you don't think, then, that the idea of cutting taxes is, as David Korn described it, a fake?
No, I don't think it's a fake. I think Republicans are sincere in what they believe.
What about the transparency?
I mean, obviously, you know, people should be more transparent. If John Boehner wants to tell people who he's meeting with, I totally support that. I don't know if Nancy Pelosi told people who she was meeting with.
I'm wondering about that, David Corn. Was she any more outgoing and open than
Well, she did
John
support.
Bain?
You know, she did support the Disclose Act, which the House passed, which the Republicans blocked in the in the Senate.
What would that have done? For.
And that would have, in terms of the dark secret money that has flooded into campaigns this season and will continue next year and the year after, would have made people at least, it wouldn't have stopped the money, but say, who's behind this?
But what about that, Matthew Condetti? That's an issue of transparency. Why don't Republicans go for that?
I think the Republicans who oppose it, I'm of two minds on the Disclose Act because I do support greater disclosure, but I think the Republicans who oppose it do so on the basis that it would the reporting requirements are just too onerous. It'd just be another regulatory burden. And maybe if they could make it easier for people to disclose where the money is coming from and such, they would support it. But in general, I totally support disclosure of who's giving money to what.
But not necessarily supported by the Republican leadership. What about the difference between John Boehner and Mitch McConnell? Mitch McConnell openly saying, we want a one-term president. Boehner talking much more about the prospect of compromise. He, of course, is actually to be the speaker. He'll be running the House. Is there an important difference there, Matthew Continetti?
No, I think John Boehner also wants Barack Obama to be a one-term president. I think every Republican wants Barack Obama to be a one-term president. That's why they're Republicans. So you can both say that they'll work against Obama's reelection while trying to find areas in practical matters where there is room for agreement.
You mentioned non-defense discretionary spending. Let's talk a little bit about defense spending, particularly with regard to the war in Afghanistan, with a review of the strategy to be conducted very soon in the run of the 1st of December, and the president still having the midsummer of 2011 as the beginning of a drawdown. Spencer Ackerman is a reporter for Wired's Danger Room blog. Spencer Ackerman, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What about this? To what extent is this issue, especially Afghanistan, not to mention Iraq, pretty much an ignored issue during these campaigns?
Rather strikingly ignored. You didn't hear anything about Iraq during the campaign. You heard very little, except in very generic terms, from really any candidate about Afghanistan. It's an issue that doesn't really seem to have much upside for candidates in terms of incentive for talking about. Really, whichever way you break down for it. I suppose it wouldn't necessarily be surprising, given that the war is generally an unpopular war at this point, that candidates who support it wouldn't really want to discuss it, and candidates who oppose it probably know that they would have an uphill battle to actually end it, particularly given that those candidates who oppose it are part of the president's own party.
Unpopular war, is it also at the moment, or does it appear to be a war that is not succeeding?
It appears to be rather troubled on a variety of fronts. There have been some stories that have come out of Kandahar that have talked about pushing the Taliban out to and beyond the outskirts of the city and back into Pakistan. The general winter fighting season, fighting lull, has taken place right now. But it's way too difficult to judge at this point any real lasting gains from the last few months' worth of fighting, and that doesn't really augur well for the president's strategy review.
Let me go back to our earlier guest, John Fortier, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. What about the partisanship with regard to not just the war in Afghanistan, but to defense spending itself? The Secretary of Defense has talked about some cutbacks and what he regards as wasteful new programs and things of that kind. Do you see this as becoming a major partisan issue next year?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think the president is still not likely to put his mind to cutting defense spending. I think he's worried about criticism of him as a war leader. And Republicans, I think, are not going to be jumping too much on that bandwagon, given where we stand today. Even the Tea Party members, some people speculate that they are sort of pure libertarians who would really ultimately undercut defense budgets and not really be want America involved in the world. I think the evidence for the most part is against that. They may not have very formed views on foreign policy and defense spending, but they tend to be kind of pro-defense, pro-measures that the administration is doing and both administrations on anti-terror. So while, yes, a accounting for our deficits would have to take that into account, I'm not sure that this is the time that we're going to do this. In fact, I'm not really sure that this is the time we're going to have a big meeting in the minds and bringing lots of deficit spending into play. We're going to have some disagreements about that.
What about the war in Afghanistan? Now, what if it appears when it's reviewed in December to those who meet with the president, perhaps not in public, and what if they conclude that things are not going well? Do they have the option to start withdrawing sooner? Can they say this is a failing effort and we're going home? Is that even possible for a Democrat?
Well, I think this is the most difficult issue for the president within his own party. If you look at the polls, Republicans actually support the war in Afghanistan and support him more on foreign policy than they do on domestic policy. It's a question of whether the Democrats remain patient with the president. The president is going to come up on this 2011 summer deadline where he at least is supposed to start pulling back a little bit. And will he be convincing enough to his base? Will he still be in kind of a weak position? Or will the base start to say, look, we elected you in some ways as an anti-war president. We wanted you to pull out. We were patient with the surge, but now it's time to get out. And for the president, who might have to think about possibly getting a primary challenge if he were too strong on that, someone from Howard Dean or maybe a Russ Feingold who's made some comments recently that might be interpreted as wanting to do that, I think that is a concern of the president. So I think it's a very tough spot for him. If he can manage it and get it past the 2012 election without his base being too unhappy with it, that's probably a good thing for him, but he might not be able to do that so well.
John Fortier with the American Enterprise Institute, David Korn with Mother Jones Magazine, Matthew Continetti with the Weekly Standard, Spencer Ackerman with Wired's Danger Room blog, and our earlier guest Anna Fifield with the Financial Times. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Obviously, we'll be looking at all these issues in the days to come. Good to have all of you, and I hope you'll all come back. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Producers of Which Way LA, Sonia Geis, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, and Gary Scott. Managing producer Karen Ranziner, technical director Mike Newport. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla, and you can check us out on Facebook. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.